This episode is sponsored by Libra Technologies. Boost staff morale with your school or district with Libra. Imagine a place where every staff member feels seen, heard, and connected. Leveraging Libra AI helps leaders create that reality, facilitating moments that bring your educational community closer, celebrating every victory together. Let's turn your school into a connected community. For more information and a free demo, contact me at jeff@shiftingschools.com today. To another episode of Shifting Schools. I'm your host, Jeff Udick. As Tricia has left me on my own today, as she is off working on some workshops she will be giving at an upcoming conference about AI and inclusion. We both have been very busy lately at conferences and workshops, mostly around AI, which reminds me to remind you, if you're in the need of some professional development around AI, please do reach out to us. We'd love to come to your school or conference to support conversations around AI. Tricia is off presenting at CEESA this week. That is the Central and Eastern European Schools Association Conference. And next week, I'm off to Singapore to spend a week supporting AI conversations at Singapore American School. Of course, if you can't bring us to you, you can always join us at our other PD opportunities. You can always find those over on the website, shiftingschools.com. Right now, we have registration open for a 75-minute AI-fueled feedback webinar that is $65. But of course, you can save $25 for being a podcast listener. And using code SSPOD25, that's all caps when you check out. Or we have a three-part webinar series on April 16th, 17th, and 18th that will cover three strategies for AI literacy conversations within your classroom. That three-part series is $175, but again, you can save $25 by using code SSPOD25 at checkout. As you have heard in other recent episodes, and you'll continue to hear, we're really focused on the how around AI in education. How do you use it? How do you have conversations about it? How do you teach it, assess it, and integrate it? Stay tuned for more on that here on the podcast and over at shiftingschools.com. All right, now for today's episode. Have you ever wondered how the passion and perspective of youth can transform our approach to topics like, I don't know, say the climate crisis? Well, today's episode promises to offer some inspiring insights. Today, we dive into the world of young voices and champions sustainability and climate action. I am thrilled to be joined by Zach, the dynamic host of the We the Children podcast. Zach, who is 12, shares his journey into podcasts, beginning with a desire to make a difference in the world by addressing climate change and sustainability issues. Through his podcast, Zach engages with experts, activists, and fellow youth to explore innovative solutions and inspire action towards a sustainable future. Zach's work not only highlights the urgency of addressing climate change, but also demonstrates the power of youth advocacy in driving meaningful change. Now, before we head over to hear more from Zach, here is a quick shout out to today's show sponsors. We're excited to have GameStormers as a sponsor of the podcast. GameStormers is a creative storytelling card game for the classroom. In GameStormers, students aim to design the best five-card narrative using cards from themes such as fantasy, sci-fi, and civilizations, complete with gorgeous art. Each student pitches their five-card story to the other players, hoping to be voted best overall narrative. All games come with free, standards-aligned lessons on topics such as persuasive speaking, narrative writing, playful assessment, and more. Get your copy and access the free lessons at gamestormedu.com today. And now, let's welcome Zach to the show and dive into a conversation that promises to bring a smile to your face no matter where you are listening from. Hearing kids' voices just does that to you. And with that, on the show. right. Welcome back to the Shifting Schools podcast. I'm so excited today. I am joined by Zach from We the Children podcast. Zach, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. I'm doing fine. It's glad to have you here. Excited to talk about this is your second podcast project called We the Children, and we'll make sure we link over to the podcast in the show notes. And it's a podcast about sustainability and the climate. Can you talk to our listeners about what could they expect when they go over and start listening to your show?
Yeah. So We the Children is a podcast project dedicated to exploring sustainability and climate crisis through the lens of a 12-year-old host, me. Each episode, my guests and I delve into various topics related to environmental sustainability, climate change, conservation efforts, and innovative solutions. Through interviews, discussions, and storytelling, my podcast hopes to educate and inspire listeners of all ages to take action towards a more sustainable future. My hope is that We the Children is a podcast that serves as a call to action for individuals, communities, and policymakers to prioritize sustainability and take meaningful steps towards a healthier planet for future generations. I know that many people get stressed or anxious thinking about the climate, but there is something we can all do to help. This year, we are working with a new production company called Lower Street, and they're helping with the interviews and really talking about climate change issues from all over the world. We're also focusing on how we can help teachers and schools with this podcast as well. We heard from a teacher in Ohio who reached out to me last year and shared that she assigned We the Children podcast to her science students. The assignment was to pick an episode and then listen to it and then send me a postcard about the episode. And it's pretty cool to get your mailbox and get these amazing hand-drawn postcards from the fifth graders in Ohio. They also write about which episode they've seen, and a lot of them have listened to all of season one, and they inspire me to keep going. It's cool. Really cool, and I'm grateful that the amazing fifth grade teacher assigned it. I'm excited that the podcast can be a valuable resource for teachers looking to bring climate change and sustainability in their classrooms. And then each episode, we also try to engage the audience in real-life stories and perspectives from people who are actively engaged in environmental activism and sustainability initiatives. And then by using these stories as part of classroom discussions or assignments, teachers can make the topics of climate change more engaging and relevant to their own students' lives. So that's what I hope, at least.
That's pretty cool. I love that. Are there other podcasts that you'd like to listen to?
Yeah. So some other, I love a lot of podcasts, especially How I Built This with Guy Raz. I really like that one. We just listened to one the other day, actually. I think he was interviewing a guy from Heirloom or something. They talk about how his company is approaching carbon removal with limestone.
Very cool. We here at Shifting Schools, you know, we are big advocates for students learning to podcast, and we talk a lot about all the different skills that you can acquire in becoming a podcaster. Can you maybe touch on this as a 12-year-old? What are some of those skills that you feel that you've really started to hone in podcasting, and maybe even how they've supported you in some of your other schoolwork?
Yeah. So I started the podcast as actually a writing assignment with one of my teachers during the first summer of COVID. She was my tutor over the summer.
Oh, cool.
And we wanted to work on my writing, and she suggested that we do a podcast because it's a fun, you know, way to write scripts, and you get to do all that. So we did one about my dog, Ewok, is his name, from Star Wars, and it's about how to raise a dog from his point of view. He's the host.
Oh, cool.
And we made about 10 episodes of that one, but then I decided I really wanted to make a more serious podcast, and I thought climate change was a very important topic, so that's how We the Children came about. And I also didn't think enough people were talking about climate change, so even more reason to do it on that. Some skills that have helped me, I think my communication skills are really improved since I started my podcast. I can speak clearly and effectively, you know, which I didn't really used to be. I kind of used to be very shy, but now I think I've kind of opened up.
That's cool.
Yeah, so it's really cool. And then we also write all the questions ahead of the interview, and but there are also a lot of the time follow-up questions that I want to ask, so that's fun to figure out, like, oh, should I ask this or this? Oh, no, they answered that, so maybe I should ask this one instead.
Oh, cool.
Our conversation with Zach will continue after this quick word from our show sponsor.
Let's talk about GameStorm EDU. Their educational card game, GameStormers, allows students to become game designers, writers, persuasive speakers, and most importantly, storytellers. During the game, each player assumes the role of an up-and-coming creator trying to make the next big game narrative. As students select cards they will use to create their ideal five-card story, they use critical thinking and creativity to determine how to weave each card into the overall tale they will share at the end of the game. The best part? Each student flexes their persuasive speaking muscles in pitching their idea to the judge for the round and the other players, hoping to win them over with their narrative. GameStormers works well for learners as young as 6 years old who use the game's beautiful art to tell their tale. While the mechanics are unique enough to appeal to high schoolers aiming to use the ideas generated to develop their own game designs. For educators, GameStormerEDU.com provides all of the standard aligned lessons necessary to launch into creative activities following gameplay. Lessons include topics such as the math of game design, learning vocabulary through gameplay learning, engaging in narrative writing, and more. Score your copy of GameStormers and access these free lessons at GameStormEDU.com today. How do you find people to interview? Do you just contact people on the web? People are always asking, like, how do you find people to interview? It's like, it's pretty funny. You can usually just ask people and they want to come on and talk.
Yeah, I think every interview we've had 15 interviews so far for this whole podcast.
Yeah.
For all 15 episodes that we've done so far. We actually haven't even released the 15th yet. But we have the interview done. Yeah. And there has only been one time that someone said no.
Yeah, right?
So, cool. Yeah, 16 times we've asked people. 15 out of those 16 times they've said, sure, yeah, that sounds like so much fun.
Yeah. And that's what I find, too. It's the same thing. People like talking about the things they love.
Yeah. To find them, I mean, sometimes we find them on TV shows, like Gabe. Yeah. Gabe Brown, we watched a documentary, and we saw him in it, and he was like, oh, that would be a really fun interview.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Or other podcasts, like you're listening to Guy Raz, and you're just like, oh, yeah, I'll reach out to him. Well, your podcast work has also brought you new opportunities. Can you share experiences that you've had because you've become this podcaster and you've created this podcast?
Yeah, so I think the most significant experience that I've had due to my podcast work is probably the opportunity to connect with so many amazing people in the sustainability and climate activism community.
Mm-hmm.
I've interviewed a few pretty prominent environmentalists, scientists, and youth activists who are leading efforts to address climate change and promote sustainability. Last year, I actually interviewed Dr. Heidi Silvestre. She is a glaciologist from Svalbard, and she said that about 70% of the fresh water in Earth is being held in snow and ice, and that part really stood out to me. I thought was really incredible. And then she also went on to be on a TV show called Arctic Ascent, where she was in Greenland with the Alex Honnold, who climbed El Cap in Yosemite. Mm-hmm. And she did climate research. And it was really cool to interview her and then see her on TV. It's a great show. And I'm actually helping at an event this weekend with the organization Roots and Shoots from Jane Goodall.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, I'm excited for that.
That's
so
cool.
Yeah, there have been a few really cool opportunities.
Awesome. Is there anything else I haven't asked you about that you wanted to share with educators and tech coaches and principals who listen to the podcast?
Yeah, I just want people to pay attention. Like, that's our single biggest issue, really. If we don't make progress in the next 5 years, we will reach the point of no return. And that is particularly hard on my generation. Adults might not feel the full pain of it, but my friends and I will.
Yeah.
And then I do think we all need to have more conversations on climate change. We need fossil fuel companies to get on board to help. And I would love to see a documentary or TV show with kids and families talking about how to fight climate change, for example, or how families can work towards solutions. But sadly, I don't think TV networks would be interested in promoting that as a show.
Yeah, I don't know what the it's all about numbers, and I don't know if what the mm-hmm. you know, not always the things we need to be talking about are the things that get talked about. But you know what, we have podcasts and we can talk about whatever we need to talk about. But your podcast is really popular. I mean, just to show that this is a conversation that people are willing to listen to. I think last year I was looking on your website, you had 300,000 downloads last year.
Yeah, actually I was looking this morning. As of this morning, we have 500,000 downloads.
Wow. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. And so there are people, you know, and I love that this is your, you know, you pick a lane, you've kind of stayed with your lane. You know, being 12 years old, talking to other kids, it's a great podcast. If other listeners out there listening to our podcast, you got to go give this a listen. It's a fantastic podcast called We the Children, with Zach talking about climate change and stuff. So it's so great to see you doing the work and picking a topic that is passionate to you and that we all need to be paying more attention to, and doing your part to pay attention to it. If there are educators or teachers or even students who might be listening to this podcast and they want to reach out to you to learn more about you, or maybe to invite you to their school or learn more about the podcast, where should they go?
So we have our podcast is, our website is wethechildrenpodcast.com.
All right.
And you can contact us from there.
Okay.
Yeah, that's probably the easiest way, really.
Okay. And are you on social media anywhere? I know that there's a lot of people that like to follow you on social media.
Right. Our social medias are, it's just at wethechildrenpodcast.
Oh, great.
For Instagram and for Facebook. And I don't think we're on X. I'm not sure.
Yeah. X. Well, we'll make sure that there are links to all of that in the show notes as well. So people can make it very easy and go into the show notes and just click on those. So appreciate it. Well, Zach, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I know you're busy with school and podcasting and sounds like running a whole business at this point. So appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to meet with us.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Did you love learning about Zach's podcast? Well, guess what? We thought you'd want to hear some of his work right away. So you are about to hear part of the special We the Children episode that's entitled Be Sustainable, Saving Our Planet's Pollinators with Melanie Kirby. If you want to hear that episode in full, you can head to the website wethechildrenpodcast.com. Hope you enjoy this segment of Zach's show.
Sometimes humans think they know better than nature, but we have to remember that we are a part of nature. And sometimes, even though we may be well-intentioned or think we're doing something positive, if we don't stop and think about how it connects to everything else, we might overlook something and it might end up being kind of negative.
When I think about the future, I can't help but wonder what kind of world will be waiting for kids like me. Will we still see vibrant fall colors? Will we still be able to save our endangered species like sea turtles and tigers? Will families still be able to live close to the ocean? I'd like to think so. That's why I'm trying to learn as much as I can about climate change science, stories, and solutions, and share what I learn with all of you. Together, we can decide what type of future we want for our planet, and discover the power we have in shaping it. This is We the Children, the podcast where kids talk climate change. I'm Zach, your host. I'm 12 years old and based in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Claire, fellow eco-enthusiast, and Zach's teacher.
Hey, Claire, can you guess which food has an infinite shelf life?
I'd say Twinkies, but that's probably not a food, is it?
No, but it is something sweet. It's honey. Did you know that archaeologists found honey in King Tut's tomb in Egypt that was over 3,000 years old? And it was still edible.
Whoa, that's incredible. Also hard to believe?
It's true. Honey, while sweet and delicious, has also been considered a medicine in many cultures for thousands of years. And while honey by itself is amazing, what's even more fascinating is who makes it. Bees.
Okay, now I'm interested, and maybe a little hungry.
Our guest today is an expert in all things bees. In fact, working with bees has taken her all around the world, including South America, Mexico, Jamaica, Nicaragua, Spain, France, Italy, and Canada. Coming to us from Santa Fe, New Mexico, Melanie Kirby is an expert in beekeeping, bee research, and pollinator conservation. She's also a queen bee breeder. How cool is that? With a commitment to preserving our planet's ecosystems, Melanie's work revolves around understanding and protecting bees. From bee conservation and habitat preservation to community engagement and education, Melanie's dedication is truly inspiring. Through her role as co-founder of Zia Queen Bees, she specializes in breeding regionally adaptive bees in the southern Rocky Mountains. Melanie is a Fulbright National Geographic Storytelling Fellow and holds a graduate degree in entomology. She's a writer, researcher, artist, and mom. I can't wait to learn more about the critical role bees play in our ecosystem. So let's get the latest buzz about bees from Melanie Kirby.
I like to tell people that the bees found me by assignment. I enlisted as a United States Peace Corps volunteer, and I was stationed in Paraguay in South America as a beekeeping extensionist volunteer, and I really didn't know much about them until that experience. And so they found me in the jungles of South America, and I'm very happy they did.
What role do bees play in our ecosystem?
Bees play a very significant role in our ecosystems. They provide a myriad of ecosystem services. One of the main ones, of course, that people think of is pollination. So many bees rely on pollen as part of their nutrition. The pollen is their protein and nectar is their carbohydrate, and they need both to have a complete diet. But some bee species are very, what we call, flower specific, and they'll only eat from certain flowers. And then there are some that are generalists. They will actually eat from all different kinds of flowers. Depending on the kind of bee, they provide a really unique and important service to the plants that they're visiting by helping to pollinate them.
This process allows the plant to bear fruit or seeds. So bees, in a big way, help create the future. Those seeds become the next generation, carrying with them the memories of the seasons before. All this impacts us as well. The plants the bees pollinate become the food that we eat.
They also help to produce a lot of different plant medicines as well, which help to keep us healthy, but also help to keep a lot of different wild animals healthy too.
Can you talk us through how your work with bees has changed over time?
My experience as a volunteer was really enlightening. I got to work with different cultures. I actually got to work a lot with indigenous farmers, the Guarani people in Paraguay. And a lot of them grew food just for their family. And they also were interested in being able to produce honey, which for them and for many people around the world is considered medicine. So I was able to work with different people in my community. I worked with a women's group. I also worked with several farmers to help them establish beehives. It was really exciting because, you know, we were in the jungles and then we would find these wild hives that were living in the cocoa trees. We would cut down these old cocoa trees, which weren't actually alive anymore. That's why the bees were able to live inside of them. And we would do what was called a trasiego, which was actually just relocating the bees from the log into a box that then we could carry back to the apiary, which is a place where bees are kept, and then be able to manage them. And then they could harvest honey from them. as they filled up. So that was my first experience with working with others. And then I ended up just really becoming quite fascinated with bees. And one of my really good friends in Peace Corps had grown up in Hawaii. And so her mom had invited me out to go visit. She had a flower farm, so I got to work at a flower farm. And while I was there on the Big Island of Hawaii, I learned that there were several what we call commercial queen rearing operations, where they make a bunch of queen bees that then they share with beekeepers all over the country and even ship internationally. I started working at one of those places and was there for a season and then switched to another one that was there on the Big Island and was there for 5 years learning how to rear queen mama bees.
But after 5 years on Hawaii's Big Island, Melanie was ready to embark on a new adventure and learn more about sustainable beekeeping practices. She was quickly introduced to migratory beekeeping. Also known as mobile beekeeping, migratory beekeeping involves actually moving bee colonies from one place to another to improve honey production, pollination services, and sometimes both. Mobile beekeepers will load their beehives onto trucks or trailers and travel often hundreds or even thousands of miles to all kinds of agricultural regions where crops or wildflowers require pollination services. This led her to Florida, where she met her farm partner, Mark.
Mark's from Michigan, but he would take his bees in the winter to Florida, where it was warmer. So we started moving his bees from Michigan to Florida, and then I helped him multiply them because I knew how to make queen bees. And so we left half of, I call it his flock, in Michigan, and we brought the other half to New Mexico. And so, yeah, we used to move our bees between Michigan and New Mexico, and then now more recently between New Mexico and California, where we actually do what's called breeding exchanges. So we're able to follow the different blooms in different places. And some places, of course, their spring comes earlier. So we can go to those places and be able to help multiply our bees and then share them with people and then come back to our home region and do it again.
Definition time. A breeding exchange refers to a collaborative effort among beekeepers to exchange queen bees or genetic material in order to introduce new traits into a bee colony. This practice helps beekeepers improve the resilience, productivity, and adaptability of their bee populations by incorporating desirable traits such as disease resistance, honey production, and temperament. It's also a community exchange where beekeepers share their expertise and unique experiences, as well as invaluable resources that support sustainable breeding strategies and conservation. How does your cultural heritage inform the work that you do?
Thanks for asking. I grew up in southern New Mexico. My family is a part of what's called Tortugas Pueblo. Tortugas Pueblo is a state-recognized tribal community. And so what that means is that we don't have a designated space, but our community has actually been in the same place for a really, really, really long time. It's a smaller community, but we actually do follow a lot of our ancestral practices. What's interesting about being an Indigenous person is that we come to learn that there's so many different kinds of Indigenous people around the world. And so not all tribes are the same, but there are some similarities. And one of the, I want to say, sort of philosophical underpinnings of many Indigenous communities is that we recognize how interconnected everything is. And we also realize that our actions really help to either encourage or to not encourage certain things. So we work together with our environment to try and live more peacefully and also in positive stewardship with the planet. For me, as a beekeeper, my cultural heritage really instilled in me a profound sense of reverence. I feel really grateful to be alive, but also to be a part of nature and to be able to support nature because it also supports me. I have the added benefit of being a researcher and also working at a tribal college where I get to teach about beekeeping and pollinator stewardship. So I do a few different things all under the hat of pollinator advocacy.
Can you guess how many different types of bee species there are in the world? It turns out that there are over 20,000 different kinds of bees.
depending on where you live, there's going to be some that are very specific to where you are. So for instance, where I live in New Mexico, we have about 1,400 different kinds of bee species here. So we're in a real hotbed of what we call pollinator biodiversity right here in the Southern Rocky Mountains. And a lot of that is just due to our landscape. Some bees really like it where it's warm. Others like it where it's cold. Some like it where it's jungles or deserts. But they all learn from their environment how to actually survive. And so they are as much a part of the ecosystem as they are helping to reproduce it.
Most of us are probably familiar with some of the more commonly known bees, like honeybees and bumblebees, but there are so many kinds of bees to learn about.
Both honeybees and bumblebees are what we call social bees, so they tend to live in a little cluster in a hive or a colony. And then we also have some really cool alkaline bees, which are green little sweat bees, and they're metallic looking, and they're bright green, and they usually come out early in the season into the orchards. We also have other types of orchard bees or mason bees. These are bees that will make little clay tubes in order to rear their young in. And some of those bee species are what we call solitary. So they live alone. They don't live in a hive family, but they do come out and interact with each other each season. And then there are even some ground nesting bees as well that like to make their home in the ground, like bumblebees, but they may also be solitary.
It's incredible how many types there are and how unique they all are.
And they look so different. You know, some of them, the males have yellow eyes. Others, they're black eyes. There's even some bees in Australia that are bright blue. Some are really fuzzy. Some may be a little bit more kind of shiny looking like a wasp, but they're very different from wasps. Although I think historically, researchers have thought that most bees have come from a wasp, and wasps are solitary. So at some point, the wasps recognized that maybe it was better to work with others. And so they formed a family and a colony, and then they became a hive.
Honey has been celebrated throughout human history, playing significant roles in different cultures and religions, starting all the way back with ancient civilizations. And as Melanie mentioned, honey has been used as medicine for thousands of years. In ancient times, it was applied to wounds for its antibacterial properties and consumed to treat a variety of ailments. Hippocrates, the ancient Greek physician known as the father of medicine, prescribed honey for lots of medical conditions, including sore throats and digestive issues. But making honey is no easy task. Honeybees visit about 2 million flowers to make 1 pound of honey. And how they turn flower pollen into liquid gold is truly a remarkable process.
Bees make honey through a lot of hard work, that's for sure. The pollen is their protein and the nectar is their carbohydrate. So they need that to be a complete diet, not only for themselves, but also for any babies that they're rearing. So what'll happen is as a bee is born, she actually has several different jobs in her life. And the very first job is usually as a housekeeper bee. She will tend to the rest of the hive. She'll help to keep it clean. And then after a few days of that, she has special glands in her mouth that she can then start to produce royal jelly, which is kind of like mother's milk. It's really concentrated and full of a lot of vitamins. What she'll do is she'll now be able to go and feed all the other little tiny baby bee larvae. So they look like little grubs. And she'll feed them so that then they can grow. After a while, though, those glands sort of minimize, and then she can actually start to do other jobs. And one of them is to become a forager.
The forager bees are the ones that go out into the wild to gather pollen and nectar, which they will then bring back to the hive.
And what ends up happening is that nectar is actually really watery. And so if they were to just put that in their honeycomb, it would actually ferment and make them sick. So one of the ways that they've learned how to make it last for a long time is to turn it into honey. And so the bee actually has two stomachs. One is one where she actually eats and digests. The other one is kind of, we call it a little honey crop, and it's just a little pouch where she holds the nectar and she brings it back, and then she can actually pass it to her sisters. It mixes with enzymes in their mandibular glands in their mouth area, and then they will basically store it into the honeycomb. They actually will also fan it too. They'll beat their wings really fast to move the air like an air conditioner so that then it can help to dehydrate the honey and remove some of the water. And that way it gets thicker. Once it gets thicker, then all of the plant sugars that were in that nectar become concentrated and it actually turns into honey. So it takes a lot of them to produce not only enough to feed their family, but also even extra that then beekeepers can harvest. And what's really cool to also consider too is that the honey that they collect is going to taste different depending on the flowers that they collect it from.
What do bees need to be healthy and to thrive?
I'm so glad you asked. Main thing they need is good, healthy forage.
Definition time. When Melanie says forage, she means flowers. Forage is an integral aspect of the relationship between flowers and bees, supporting pollination, reproduction, and ecosystem health. For the flowers, forage is a vital part of their reproductive cycle. They rely on pollinators like honeybees to transfer pollen between flowers, enabling fertilization and the production of seeds. In return, bees receive nectar and pollen as food sources, ensuring their survival and providing energy for colony growth and maintenance. Flowers and bees have co-evolved over millions of years, developing a mutually beneficial relationship. The availability of diverse flowering plants is crucial for supporting bee populations and promoting biodiversity.
It's all about the flower power. Bees are really, really intelligent. The reason they collect so much nectar and pollen is because for those bees that live in places that have a really cold winter, they know that the temperatures are going to get cold enough that then there won't be any flowers, but they still need to eat. So they will collect as much as they can during the warm season and store it so that then there's enough for them to eat through the wintertime. It's like having their own pantry. And so interestingly, for them to be healthy and to thrive, they need to be able to have a diverse amount of food, amount of flowers. And also, each of those flowers, not only does it have different flavors, but they have different vitamins and minerals that they need. So one of the ways that we can help to ensure that is by making sure that we plant enough flowers and to avoid toxic sprays or chemicals that might contaminate their food. Sometimes humans think they know better than nature, but we have to remember that we are a part of nature. And sometimes, even though we may be well-intentioned or think we're doing something positive, if we don't stop and think about how it connects to everything else, we might overlook something and it might end up being kind of negative. So yeah, I mean, being mindful of what we choose to eat, what we choose to grow, and how we care for it, and how we care for our spaces, for our land, and for our water, and for our air, all of that is required for things to live healthy, and including us.
It's amazing learning about the vital role bees play in pollination, ecosystems, and agriculture. In the United States, bee populations are declining due to parasites, pesticides, habitat loss, and disease. This has a major implication for food production and the very delicate ecosystem health we are discussing here today. What small actions can you and your family take to keep bees healthy? Are there areas in your life where you can raise awareness about the importance of bees and other pollinators?
To listen to more of We the Children with this week's special guest, head over to the show notes to learn more about that show. We hope that this episode gets you inspired and ready for the upcoming Earth Day celebration. We are going to bring you a special episode next week that updates our ChatGPT and Earth Day guide. So be on the lookout for that, and thanks again for listening.